Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Hey, football fans, it's Patrick Peterson, former three-time All-Pro NFL cornerback, and now the new host of First and Pod, the podcast that breaks down every game, every week, with new episodes dropping every Monday and Friday mornings. Plus, I'll be highlighting key matchups for DBs around the league on Patrick's Corner. Be sure to subscribe to First and Pod on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Let's do this Chris Herrington deal. Chris Herrington joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
So, You Spin Me Round, a little new wave one-hit wonder by Dead or Alive from the 80s. That's going out to John Morant for spinning Anthony Edwards completely around in his game-winning basket over the weekend.
Yeah, it was handy to have you there for that one. That was certainly one of the great games of this season. I don't know, like you always do your best moments at the end of the year, but that job bucket's going to, I presume, going to be in the... I'm just going to go ahead and say it's going to crack the top 15.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have it all in my head right now, but I'm keeping a list, so that will definitely make the contenders list quite easily, yes. Yeah.
Well, let's start with Ja. He obviously struggled all game long, 3 of 17 up until that point, and then the last two buckets. One, as you pointed out in your piece, and I've tweeted it out, people can read it, one sort of a type we've seen before. The second one, maybe of a type we haven't. How was Ja talking about it?
He was not very talkative. I mean, he said, I mean, they all basically sit around and look at their phones because that is the curse that, you know, we all have, especially younger people now. You walk in the locker room, everyone's just sitting around with their feet in ice looking at their phones individually. That's the way it works. He sat for a long time looking at his phone, and then he didn't talk. He wasn't really in a very, very talkative mood. He was perfectly nice about it, but he just really wasn't that interested in talking.
Right.
So he didn't have much to say. Like I included his quote. I asked him to describe the play, and he described it as a very mundane kind of thing. You know, it's whenever I had a timeout set, and Dez sort of gave me a nod to take it myself, and then I made the shot I usually make, which is a floater. And he made it sound very mundane, which of course it was not. If you watch it, not only was the shot like it was a floater, but it was like this high arcing, twisting. It was like a really tough shot. But to get the shot, it was total improvisation. Like no one drew up. Like their set is not for Ja Morant to catch the ball and do a complete 180 roadrunner circle like through and around two defenders to get to the baseline to make a high floater over Rudy Gobert. Like, that is not the set, right? That's Ja Morant improvising in action.
Yeah. What have you thought of Ja since his return, by the way? Just generally speaking, how does he appear to you?
Well, he's only played two games.
Right.
Since his return, so that's not much to go on. And one of those games, did he score like 30 or something against Houston? He had a big scoring night against Houston in that loss.
Yeah, he had like 27, but no assists, essentially. I mean, not very few assists.
Yeah, but to me, the assist thing was not a reflection of him. That was more of a team reflection.
Yep.
The thing about the Houston game was like he was getting into the lane and getting shots whenever he wanted to, right? And so, you know, there didn't seem to be any diminishment there. I did think that in the obviously, he was 3-17 before those last two shots, but also a lot of it just seemed short. Like, he seemed like he wasn't quite, you know. I wonder about and I worry about, and it's two games, so we need to keep, you know, just watch it as it unfolds. But I wonder about the injury accumulation with him, both physically and mentally, honestly. Like, there's just, he's had two pretty major injuries. He's come back earlier than I expected on both of them, with the shoulder sprain and the hip thing. And both of those seem sort of like, you know, dodge a bullet kind of situations that could have been way worse than they were. And given just the accumulation, just the constant stuff with him, I wonder about, you know, the buildup, the wear and tear buildup on him physically with all that accumulation of injuries. And you have to wonder about, like, or does it, you know, does it weigh on you mentally to, like, you know, when you're just, you're getting hit and getting hurt all the time, right? So I'm a little concerned about him in that regard, but, like, that's a sit that in the back of your mind and watch and see what happens. Like, that's not predictive. Right. I don't know. He could come out and just be incredible tonight. I really don't know.
No, I actually have some of those same concerns, though. If you're out that much, I think it's hard to be your best finely tuned self, right? I mean, it's whether it's the shooting or anything else. And then sometimes his body language can look a little exhausted, honestly, which I totally get. All of this in the wake of... Yeah, go ahead.
At the end of that, I don't know what you could see on the TV, on the broadcast, because I haven't gone back to look at it, but like when the final buzzer sounded, that was not an exultant Ja Morant. He looked exhausted. And he had only played like 29 minutes, but he looked completely spent at the end of that game.
Yeah. And of course, this is all in the wake of Ja being making an absolutely ridiculous shot to win it, which Anthony Edwards tried to do but could not do twice, really. There's a long piece in The Athletic today about, or that was yesterday, today, whatever, in the wake of that game.
John Krasinski? I haven't read it yet, but I'm friendly with John. We actually had lunch a couple days ago.
Yeah, it's sort of like they took... This loss was a cause for deep soul searching on that team, right?
Oh, it was. That mood, I haven't read John's piece, but like that was the mood there. It was not a like, oh, you know, shot goes in, shot goes out, you know. Yeah. That game could have gone either way easily. They were down about that game, people around the Wolves, yeah.
And it was, I guess, twofold. And we see these things from our perspectives when the Grizzlies struggle with a team or whatever, but it's the Grizzlies doing it again after having beaten them in that, you know, the series, the memorable series. And then it was, what else can we do, given how well they shot the ball, which was extraordinary. DiVincenzo was unbelievable. I mean, they just right down the line. I think they shot 57% from the field. So what more do we have to do? There was part of that. But then also, there was real criticism, honestly, of Ant and the last play. Like, that did not go the way it was supposed to go.
Well, I mean, when I went back, I went back and rewatched some of those late plays because, like, honestly, you've been in that building for like playoff games.
Yep.
Where you sit, when it really gets rowdy, you can't hardly see.
No,
like you can feel it, but you can't hardly see it when the other people start standing up. And so, like, when I went back and rewatched, I feel like Ant probably takes that shot regardless. But Julius Randle, once the ball goes to Ant, like, Ja sort of gets lost on that. And so Julius Randle could have, like, flashed up to the free throw line and had been wide open, like, going downhill against Jaren, and maybe you get a foul or you get a floater or whatever to tie. I think Ant's probably just taking that shot, period. But I think Randle sort of quit on the play once he passed the ball. I mean, Edwards is their best guy, like, he's made plenty of big shots, and, like, he could have made that one. He could have made one of those two shots. Ja could have missed one of those two shots, and then the game flips. But that was not the attitude. It's funny. It is like all fan bases are in the dumps when you lose, and then you're exultant when you win. Like, it's a good reminder. That's just the way it is. But, like, in Minnesota, there's a real, like, there's a feel of, like, real dedication to the team and real, like, beaten down quality of, like, we can never have nice things. And I think after that trade, there's sort of part of that too. It was funny. Like when I was working on the story, I got to know most of the people who cover the Wolves during the playoff series a couple years ago. And so when I was working on my story, this wasn't John Krasinski, the guy you're mentioning, but someone else, as he was leaving, you know, stopped to say goodbye to me and said, you know, have fun covering a team that he said, you know, enjoy covering a team that's actually fun. It's like your team. You got Anthony Edwards. Yeah. Like, you know, you're in the playoff mix. Like, it's not that bad. Look up, pal. You know, it's not that bad.
Yeah, that's hilarious. And in fact, like moving DiVincenzo into the starting lineup. I mean, he was terrific. Is this? We think Mike's been moved to the bench now. Whatever, at least for now, but permanently? What do you make of what's happening?
I think that's probably permanent. I think there's two things there. I think Conley is, and I talked to Mike a little bit before the game. Conley, I mean, he's like 38 or 37 or whatever, and he's had some injury stuff. I think there's a natural decline with Conley, and I think that's not going to change. I also think that the lineup stuff, there was a sense that they needed there are a lot of people around that team who think that Randle should be coming off the bench and they should be starting Nasri, but they're just not going to do that.
Right.
And so in lieu of that change, there's a general sense that not only is like DiVincenzo probably better than Mike Conley right now, but just over the course of 48 minutes, you get better lineups. Like Conley wasn't good even when he played in that game, but he has been better since the lineup change. And I think part of the rationale, the way they see it, is when Conley is the starter, like Edwards and Randle are both dominating the ball so much, he's basically just a spot-up shooter.
Right.
And when he comes off the bench, he can play in lines where he can function a little bit more as like an actual point guard, which is sort of what his instinct is, and that makes Conley a little bit better. So I think there's a general belief that not only is just DiVincenzo better right now, but that across 48 minutes, it's sort of the best for everybody.
As you point out, a good game could have gone either way, and it is people overreact. Like, had the Grizzlies lost, you would have then faced the really a game that was not as close as it has appeared against Houston last week, and then the score indicated at the end, and then you're going to lose to Minnesota, and then you got another Houston game tonight. People could be in a sort of a existential crisis, maybe in the same way that fans could be, in the same way that Minnesota was after that game. In the end, it's a shot that goes in and a shot that doesn't go in. Like, that was a wildly competitive, highly entertaining game. And for the Grizzlies, a lot of good things came out of it apart from the miss make at the end, including, let's start with Zach Edey. I thought he was good.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big test. I was interested in both the rookies in that game in particular. It was the first time Jalen Wells was playing against Anthony Edwards. It was also the first time Zach Edey was playing against Rudy Gobert. And when you think of not just quality of player, but the physicality of a matchup as a rookie, like, those are two of the most extreme, like, physical challenges those two guys were going to face this season. And there was a real worry they would both just be swallowed up by that. And Edey was not swallowed up by Rudy Gobert. It's funny, I went and looked at, because I know some of the Wolves media people, I went and looked at some of their social media feeds and some of the responses they had to some of the things that were posted. And there's lots of Wolves fans that are just like, they think Zach Edey bullied Rudy Gobert in that game. I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but he certainly held his own against Rudy Gobert in that game. You know, got off to a good start, you know, and then you didn't really score much after that. But the Grizzlies just poured offensive rebounds, and Edey got 7 of those, and then his presence, I think, helps them get more. So he really held his own in that matchup.
And then the other rookie, Jalen Wells, I saw you wrote about this in your piece, because heading into the piece, there's been a lot written and said about Jalen Wells as a taking the toughest matchup on the other team. But as you, it's something you asked Taylor Jenkins about, some of those matchups seem more naturally fitting for him than others. And so this was more of a test. Explain what you asked him about. Go ahead.
My perception of watching Anthony Edwards had been that, you know, they've had him guard the other team's top perimeter scorer, whether it's the point guard, scoring guard, or small forward, pretty much every game. My perception watching him has been that even though he's 6'8", he has done a better job scaling down to the smaller guards, where he's sort of quick. He's really good at navigating screens, so he's been good at, you know, sticking to his man, and then he has the length advantage. My perception is that he's struggled more against the stronger wings just because of the strength issue as a rookie. I was very careful to ask that question pregame in a way that was not leading. I basically just said, you know, you use Edwards against all these kind of matchups, or Wells against all these kind of matchups. What's your perception of how he's handled guarding smaller players versus guarding bigger wings? So I was very careful not to, like, lead with the question.
Right.
And Jenkins' response was exactly what my perception was. And he was pretty frank about it. He said, you know, he's done a great job against these smaller guards. The bigger wings is more of a challenge for him, or more of a, I think, called it a growth opportunity. That's what we say now. The players don't have weaknesses. They have growth opportunities.
We do.
He said that that's a growth opportunity for him. We love giving him that challenge. And so then I recycled back after at the end of the game and we passed the test, right? He did a real good job with it. No, it's not just about him. And in fact, on that last shot, it wasn't him at all.
Brandon Clark
was the switch in the contest. So it's a team thing. It's not a Jalen Wells thing. But Jalen Wells does have that initial assignment and did a good job with it. And part of it's the way they've done this. Grizzlies have always had, someone's guarding the other team's best guy, whether that was, Dylan Brooks or Vince Williams last year or whatever. But what they seem to do with Jalen Wells is, doing the face guard. You just guard this guy and, ignore everything else. He's not trying to get steals and blocks and help defense or anything. He's just, guarding his guy and ignoring the rest of the game. And, that could be dangerous, but it's worked for the Grizzlies. That strategy has worked for them, I think, for the most part this season.
So he was great. Brandon Clark, as you point out, terrific on that last switch to challenge the Anthony Edwards shot. And then it's almost ho-hum at this point. Jaren Jackson, fabulous again.
Jaren, man, I put out a thing I tweeted out or posted on various platforms over the weekend. I was just curious. I went and looked at it. And this is the official scoring leaders, and so there are a couple guys who would rank higher, but they haven't played enough games, Luka Doncic and LaMelo Ball. But, among the official leaders, Jaren Jackson currently has the 22nd highest scoring average in the league, which is good, but, not spectacular. When you adjust it per 48 minutes, it's fourth. And it's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Nikola Jokic, Jaren, Jason Tatum. That's the top five per-minute scorers in the league among guys who have played enough to qualify. That is crazy stuff to me, the way he's scoring.
That is crazy stuff. So you are now starting the Jaren Most Improved campaign?
I mean, if people took that award seriously, it's not just who had the big, second or third year player who's whatever, and who is actually, of course, the thing with Jaren is that it's a multi-year thing. It's not a sudden thing.
Right.
But the level of improvement, the level of consolidating the various aspects of his game and finally putting all the pieces together and then improving from there, it is really something.
Yeah. Stat, by the way, that my son Peter called to my attention to, every Grizzlies player has a positive on-court net rating. He's never seen that before.
Part of that is the Grizzlies have a really high net rating as the team. So I think they're the fourth best net rating in the league. So, when you're winning by 50 against Toronto or whatever, you sort of padding stats on that stuff. But it does give a sense of there's no drag. There's no player who's a drag on them, right? They're playing really well as a team, and their rotations are working. So, yeah.
Houston tonight. What are you going to be looking for?
Well, it's obviously, it's going to be interesting. The Memphis going into that Houston game is probably going to be similar to Minnesota coming into the Memphis game next week.
Right.
These are teams that are sort of feeling some kind of way, as they say, about the prior game. And so I got to think you'll get a good effort from the Grizzlies. They're going to really, they care about all these games, but they really probably have a chip on their shoulder about Houston. And again, you're at Houston.
Right.
And, I think there are some matchup issues there. And, we'll see, what kind of rhythm Ja is in with some of his stuff. And so, I don't really have a lot of optimism, not a pessimism about it either, but I don't feel like Grizzlies is going to go win this game. I mean, I don't know about that. But I think it'll be a really interesting game.
Grizz now 25-14. So, they got two more games till we're halfway through the season, and they're already at 25 wins, or I guess they're on pace for whatever. They're on pace for 51, 52 wins.
I think it's 53.
Is that right?
52 or 53 after that, yeah.
There you go. By the way, the other unrelated to this Grizz news, unrelated to this NBA news, is Sam Moore of Sam and Dave died, I guess, last week.
He died on Friday. I would have done it over the weekend, but I was busy with the Grizzlies game and some other stuff yesterday, but I'm working on a Central Memphis Library entry on the best of Sam and Dave, which will probably be up this afternoon. But
all right. Well, maybe I'll just wait until that. Give me the short nuts. Give me the nutshell story on Sam and Dave.
Sam Moore and Dave Prater, by the way, a common mistake. People think David Porter, the songwriter who wrote a lot of their songs and is a Memphian, was Sam Moore's singing partner. Two different Daves. Sam Moore and Dave Prater were a vocal duo out of Miami that got signed to Atlantic Records, and Jerry Wexler, the head of Atlantic, brought them to Memphis and placed them with Stax to try to you know, get something going with them. And they worked with Isaac Hayes and David Porter as a songwriting duo, and there was just instant synergy there. And they had, it was a brief run, about 4 years, 3 or 4 years, but they just hit after hit after hit. They just, it really clicked, and they really exploded out of Stax there for a few years. Sam and Dave recording with the Stax house bands and the Stax songwriting and producing teams. Soul Man, the song most people know, but lots of other great stuff. Hold On, I'm Coming, I Thank You, and Something is Wrong with My Baby. And just sort of not a lot of soul duos of an era. It's mostly an era, a genre of solo singers. But they had a real chemistry. There was a lot of sort of interactivity in their singing. It almost felt like a conversation in terms of the back and forth. And just made a lot of really exciting records in Memphis for a few years.
All right. We will look for your piece later today. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian. We're going to take a break. There's been a lot of more head coaching news, Jeffrey. We actually have an NFL vacancy that has been filled. There's been other interviews. I saw The Athletic has projected who the hire is going to be at all of these spots. So we got a lot more to talk about. We'll do that when we return. Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Jeffrey, before I get to some other matters in the world of sports, I need you to weigh in. You're going to be Judge Jeffrey here,
right,
briefly for a moment on two controversies, one in sports and one not in sports.
All right.
Okay. This one, the first one, and our friend Scott Cassiola, formerly of the CA, who, when I was at the CA, we hired Scott and he covered Ole Miss for a little bit and wrote features and absolutely terrifically gifted writer.
Very good with words.
Went on to the Wall Street Journal and now the New York Times. He wrote about this in the New York Times. Okay?
All right.
Alexis Luttrell. Have you heard about this controversy? Alexis Luttrell, who lives in Germantown. She had one of those giant-ass skeletons, you know?
Oh, yes. Okay, so I've heard of it. Okay, continue.
Yes, giant-ass skeletons, okay? And her idea was, you know what we're going to do? We're going to, the skeleton is a Halloween costume, but we're going to redecorate the skeleton seasonally, depending on whatever holiday we are celebrating. So she decided that the skeleton would wear Christmassy stuff. And so it has a red and green tutu and there's a dog also. And the dog, it's a skeleton dog, has a little bit of a Christmas tree hat. So they're red and green. Okay.
All right.
Germantown has cited her and now there's a court date set for keeping Halloween decorations up for too long. Within 45 days of the holiday for which they are intended, they have to be removed. They can be installed 45 days before, and they have to be removed in Germantown 30 days after. Okay? So that's how long you have to keep your Halloween stuff up, your Christmas stuff up, etc. This skeleton, she is arguing, is in fact a Christmas skeleton, and that's why it was up. And indeed, she's going to have it be a Valentine's schedule. She's going to have it's going to say love is love during Valentine's Day. It's going to be a Valentine's skeleton. So most people who've been cited have complied. She said, screw you, man. I celebrate Christmas the way I want to. It is with a festive green and red skeleton. How does Judge Jeffrey rule? Are you ruling in favor of Alexis Luttrell or in favor of Germantown?
All right. So there's a few questions here. Number one, who does this hurt?
The law is the law, man. Presumably they do it so they keep a tidy, You know, the German.
I mean, I will say
you
this.
You can
this
say Germantown is a little overly concerned with their image, but maybe that's why Germantown is Germantown.
Right.
Same thing. Who you're going to get pulled over by the cops in Germantown?
No, for sure.
You know,
they can confirm.
They keep a tight rein on things because they want to continue to be Germantown.
That would also
be the argument in favor. We don't want people schlocking up our yards here with all kinds of crap. You don't want Halloween decorations up in May. It looks junky.
I would argue her case saying that it's going to be a Halloween, she will decorate these skeletons for Halloween, hurts her case. Because essentially what she's saying is this is not a Christmas.
No, she's saying it is. She's saying it will be decorated however it is according to the season. Maybe in Halloween it can stand on its own.
Yeah, I mean, I would.
Halloween, it is on its face a Halloween decoration. To make it a Christmas decoration, you have to adapt it.
Correct. So therefore, it's not Christmas decorations.
No, she's made it into a Christmas decoration. I think that. Let me ask you this.
This feels like a very.
Here you go. Here's my argument.
All right.
Is a tree Christmassy? No. A tree becomes Christmassy only once you decorate it to be a Christmas tree. The difference between a Christmas tree and an evergreen is that you decorate it. So you can transform something into a Christmas decoration by decorating it. It's what, in fact, we do to Christmas trees. Otherwise, it's just a tree. Now it's a Christmas tree.
That's not motivating me. Because when you think about it in these terms, if we're just talking about a simple pine tree, okay, I can get with you there. But we don't see firs, and we don't see what we would deem to be, like, if you and I go to a lot where there are no decorated Christmas trees, there are just empty Christmas trees, you and I know those are Christmas trees.
That is true. But here's the thing. If you had a giant-ass fake tree,
okay,
fake silver tree in your yard,
this feels like an elaborate ploy to not put your decorations up.
No, I think it's I don't think it's laziness. I think she's having fun with the skeleton. I'm on her side. I think if you decorate it to fit the holiday, it becomes a Christmas skeleton. That's what I think. And who are we to decide how you decorate for Christmas? I agree. If she just left the skeleton up undecorated, that would be, that would violate the ordinance. Once she decorates it with all sorts of Christmassy things, it becomes a Christmas skeleton. And I think, honestly, it's sort of fun.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there's also...
I'm on her side.
There's the larger point. It's like, are we really wasting time with this?
Well, there's no question. That's true. Okay.
And money?
Next case.
Okay.
You remember during the World Series, those two Yankee fans...
Yes.
Who, let's be honest, assaulted Mookie Betts...
Yeah, absolutely.
...during the World Series. And at the time, they were bragging they were able to be able to come back the next night. Well, they, in the end, were not allowed to come back the next night. And now, baseball has announced its ruling, and the ruling is these two fans suspended indefinitely will be arrested on site if they are at a Major League Baseball game. Judge Jeffrey, is that a fair ruling from Major League Baseball? And is that what you, in fact, would have ruled?
Yeah, I actually think it's fair. Like, in the end, you violated your right to attend the games. You interfered with a game. I'm not saying, like, that I can't look at these human beings. They don't deserve to walk our earth, breathe our air.
You wouldn't shoot them.
But you gave up your right to go to the game.
Yeah, I think probably. I think they have to be severely punished. And so I would not, if I were an appellate judge, I would not overrule this ruling.
Yeah.
Right?
There also needs to be a deterrent for like having people interfere with games.
If I were the trial judge, I would have said banned for a year.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Like the indefinite thing
is... Indefinite, what does that even mean? Does it mean that in 6 months they can come back? 3 months? I would have just made it a year and they can come back.
Yeah.
What are we going to do? Check on their behavior to see if it's the indefinite appeal, whatever?
Well, it's like I don't want to waste a ton of security on these guys, but at the same time, like I think everything now has like face capture. Every stadium.
I would not. I would not overrule.
But like, you lost your right to go to a game.
You're being idiots. I mean, come on. They holding the.
Yeah.
I'm prying the ball out. That's ridiculous. Okay. We do have an NFL game tonight, Vikings-Rams. Game has obviously been moved to Arizona because of the fires. We now have at least 24 have been killed in the L.A. area in these fires. More strong winds expected today. Can you tell me, by the way,
what Santa Ana winds are?
Yeah, what do those winds feel like? I mean, I know you did experience a massive fire, but just generally, fire or no fire, you have these Santa Ana winds. What does a Santa Ana wind
just
feel
like? I mean, to me, it's like
it's a warm.
Yeah, they definitely come through. They definitely have. Yeah, like I would say, it's like to me. There's in the south. There's the difference. You can tell the south wind from the north wind. If you feel that wind come and it feels biting and cold, that's the north wind. Whereas if it just feels like the wind's going, that's the south wind. Whereas the Santa Ana winds, like you can, it feels like you have an air conditioner that doesn't have Freon in it, and it's just like blowing kind of like hot air. They are constant.
It's noticeable. It's not gusts.
Correct. They have gusts too, but it is a constant strong. You know, for the golfers out there, it's a 2-club, 3-club win.
And it's sort of all day long. Yes. You're dealing with Santa Ana winds?
Yeah. I mean, I mainly notice it during the day. Like, I don't know if they stay strong during the night. I can't really recall. But, yes, they're constant. And, like, you don't just – it does not feel like ocean breeze, if I would say that.
Among the other questions –
and they come from over the hill. Like, yeah. That's the other thing. So, like, the way L.A. works is – like, part of the problem with these fires is there's all this, like, rustic, you know, landscape – and the only place for it to go is like they have to climb the hill and get to the ocean. And it's like, well, that's really tough. There's a ton of ravines and just space.
Obviously, an ongoing tragedy and crisis. Again, more winds, strong winds expected today. But among the questions they will ultimately have to wrestle with is whether they're going to proceed with the 28 Olympics.
Yeah.
Given the expense that they're already going to be faced and the massive chore of rebuilding that city, there's been some question. Some have already suggested that they be moved. Going back to Paris is one idea. Obviously, it was successful in Paris. So far, at least, they have L.A. has said that the games will go on.
Yeah, part of the L.A. Olympics, and who knows if this will become a model, but L.A. was planning on using a lot of their existing facilities.
Right.
So, like they had the intention of making this profitable,
and by the way, it was profitable in Paris,
correct?
And way back when, sort of, L.A. invented the
84.
Idea of
84,
the
it was profitable. It was profitable, but my also understanding is a lot of the money that they are spending is not necessarily on transforming venues into its infrastructure.
Right.
It was trying to beef up the metro and trying to.
Well, they still have the money. They're
correct.
Going to be spending money on
correct for infrastructure.
We will see. We will see how that goes. So anyway, we got the NFL game tonight. We do have coaching news. One intriguing story that has popped up is this question of whether, and they were talking about this on Sportsmanlike, the show that precedes ours, whether Marcus Freeman should be a candidate in the NFL, and in fact, whether Marcus Freeman is the perfect coach for the Chicago Bears. If you were an NFL team, would you want to hire Marcus Freeman? And if you were Marcus Freeman, would you want to go to an NFL team? Obviously, he's got other things on his mind. As a week from today, he'll be coaching Notre Dame in the national championship game.
So if I'm an NFL team, I very much seriously want to talk to Marcus Freeman. I'd like to hear, okay, how could you make this work? If I'm Marcus Freeman, I sit there and go, thank you for your time. I'll let my agent say that I'm going to be the Bears coach, maybe get a little more money out of Notre Dame. I think
is that true no matter what NFL team it was? Is it true if the Cowboys were coming after Marcus Freeman?
I mean, if there were a team with, you know, a quarterback I believed in, I'd be very strong to listen to those offers.
You don't think Caleb Williams is someone he would believe in?
I mean, to me, that's what makes the Bears intriguing. But the problem the Bears have is they have structural problems.
How do we know? I think Marcus Freeman has become is a great story.
Yeah.
And what he's done to the culture there, the way that he's rallied his team in the face of the loss earlier this season, all of that. How do we know he'd be good of an NFL coach?
I mean, the idea that, like, in the end, part of the NFL is, like, motivating guys and whatnot, he seems to be pretty good at that. But, like, you know, the real question for me, and like, in the NFL, so much of the NFL is scheme.
It's funny, though. There has been this trend lately That's my thinking. Like, why would Marcus Freeman be high on my list when so much of the NFL is scheme, right?
Yeah.
And even from Belichick, although he was more defensive scheme, it was scheme. Like, that 100%. Was what made, yes,
combo coverages, whatever, everything. Like, yeah, the way that
it
we...
It feels like lately, though, there has been a trend towards, we're going to hire a culture guy, Dan Campbell, and that is the way, is a way to win in the NFL. Dan Campbell in Detroit. Even Sean McDermott doesn't come with as much plaudits in Buffalo. Mike Vrabel? Mike Vrabel's not scheme. Mike Vrabel is
culture
guy. That
I would argue Sean is more scheme than he gets credit.
More than he gets credit for defensively. Yes. Exactly right.
But he is clearly.
Belichick honestly gives him enormous credit. I don't know if you've seen clips of him talking about dealing with the Bills defense, but whatever. That's... It had always seemed like the genius Shanahan coaches were scheme guys in the NFL. Now there's been this separate trend towards culture guys, and Marcus Freeman is that, or sort of would fit that, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'd have to hear, like, okay, who's your staff? Like, those are things, but, like, in terms of being the leader of men, like, I firmly believe he could do that. What I would tell him, though, is you might have, like, one of the five best jobs now. Like, is in this era, Notre Dame is much more open to playing the game, and they have as much NIL power as anyone, and you're always going to have a good roster. You get to set your own schedule. Like, you're going to win.
You have to recruit every day.
You do, but you also get to recruit guys you want.
Here's my view. I just don't like the story of Marcus Freeman going to the NFL. I want Marcus Freeman. He's such a good story at Notre Dame. I want to see what happens there. The notion that he would turn it around, get him to the national championship game, and then I just don't like the tale. I don't like that. I don't like that story. That's not my fairy tale. And so I'd rather he stay put and take Notre Dame.
The other problem
is
he still has like the biggest game of his life in a week.
Well, that is certainly true. In terms of the NFL stuff, we know Vrabel to New England, and of course everyone is applauding that one. Listen, Vrabel to New England last year without Drake May would not have worried me. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
What makes Vrabel, it makes it seem like, and everyone's praising this one, is he's the culture guy, and it appears he's got the quarterback in place.
The one thing I would say is Vrabel did not do a good job on Malik Willis at all.
But and, look where he took Ryan Tannehill.
Yeah, but there's also, like, that's kind of the other thing. It's like, I think guys like him do better with the veteran quarterback that probably has a clear ceiling because they can coach around it. Like, they're never going to, whereas when you've got a guy like Drake May, you've got to kind of build around him. Whether it's like you're bringing in Tannehill, it's like, okay, we're just having Tannehill come in, hit some play action passes. Gruden was kind of known for this. Like, Gruden would always have older guys, and like, it's a good way to scheme up, like, being in that 10 win range. But it doesn't really lend itself to a high ceiling. We've not seen Vrabel come and develop a young guy.
And I, of course, hope he's going to be a disaster. 54-45 as coach of the Titans, 2-3 in the playoffs. So that one is done. Mike McCarthy now can talk to other teams. Feels like that's going to get done in Dallas, right? Do we feel like it's going to get done in Dallas unless they want to trade for Mike Tomlin?
Yeah. Why would you block McCarthy from...
Unless you're just being petty.
Right, but I don't think that's...
Okay, how about this? How about you block... A week ago when the Bears asked for permission to talk to McCarthy, it was denied. This would be the way you would deny him the right to talk to Chicago because you want to get something done.
Yep. Exclusive window.
But then conversations don't go where you want them to go, and you realize you've not gotten anything done. And now he's free to talk, and now he's free to have people back up the Brinks truck towards him, and maybe you don't want to back up the Brinks truck.
I suspect that is the case. Jerry's never been one to... I mean, I guess when he went and got Parcells, like, that was a different thing. Like, in general, he just doesn't believe in paying the coaching staff that much. Like, it's pay the roster.
There was it is kind of amazing. If you're a Titans fan right now, by the way, your running back is is still your former running back.
I can relate.
Is crushing the league. You can relate. And by the way, your former quarterback is the most applauded former head coach hire of the season. I was kind of astounded by over at The Athletic. They did some projections of who was going to end up where.
All right, let's hear.
Bears, Pete Carroll.
I can buy that. I don't love it.
Experienced head coach, culture builder, has dealt with quarterbacks before, had success with a mobile quarterback before, Pete Carroll.
I don't love it, but at the same time, I'm not as, oh my God, retread, this is doomed to fail, because I do believe what we've seen.
I don't think it'll be a disaster, honestly. No. I think there will be disappointment. I know Jason Smith will be disappointed, but I don't think it has to work, has to fail.
Like, in the end, I think Pete Carroll deserves more credit for Russell Wilson than he gets.
This is just one outlet's projection.
Yeah.
Jags, Robert Saleh. He coached there. They love him.
If I'm Saleh, don't you go back and be like, let's fix the defense at San Francisco, like reset. The Jets are still paying me.
If you've got a head coaching job, and you, in the end, it comes down to what you think of Trevor Lawrence.
Look what I guess for me, is I'm actually looking at this from the Jets. I don't think Saleh's that good of a head coach.
Well, that's my question. I think Saleh 100% takes it. The question is, if you're the Jags, do you give it to Robert Saleh?
Yeah, I would have to have a lot of people tell me no before I'm giving it to Robert Saleh.
So then, according to, again, this is just one outlet's projection, the Raiders hire Ben Johnson. Why the hell would he go there? But that's what they say.
Brady
loves him, and I guess if you're confident, you can find a quarterback?
I mean, all of the reporting is that Brady is running the show.
Right.
Like, to the point in which the league knows it. I can't remember who. Someone on Levitard said this. The league knows it. Teams know it. And that's why he's like, this is, it's going to be one and done for broadcasting, because he's basically running the Raiders.
He's not very good either.
He's like,
fine.
Yeah, that's my whole thing. It's like, how is he worth $37 million or whatever? Like, he's fine. Like, I'm not like, this is the worst broadcaster ever heard, but
no,
like
fine.
It sounds to me like a very generic analyst, a very expensive generic analyst.
But so, if you're Ben Johnson, you've got the whole world is your oyster. Why are you picking the Raiders job?
I mean, the only thing I can think of is if Brady's convincing him, we're going to do this the right way. The things that you've been asking for, we're going to do it. We're going to get you a GM that's aligned with him, because we talked about it. Was it Pelissero? What's his name?
What's
that? The GM they fired. That's actually like
Tedesco.
Telesco. Like, they got rid of him. I'm not saying, like, that guy's going to be fine. Like, he'll get a new job. But, like, to me, it's like, clear the deck so that we can build this the right way. And you don't really get that opportunity much in the NFL without being an established head coach. And so maybe he views that as, this is the one time that I'm going to get a chance to do this exactly the way that I want to. I'll go to do that.
Aaron Glenn to the Saints. I've heard that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the Saints
was there before. They like him.
I just tell, my whole thing with Aaron is, man, I hope they pay you.
And the Jets, Brian Flores.
Okay.
How do you like that?
If I'm a Bills fan, I'm not scared. Like, in the end, like, with Brian Flores, like, we're going to have to see, like, can this guy, like, what are they doing at quarterback? Like, are they going to do retread? Are they going, like, bridge? Are they just going to suck and try to get a quarterback next year?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, like, the thing is, like, we can talk about all these guys. I'm not saying, like, any of these are bad hires, but it's like, how is this any different? Like, the Jets are still going to be in the same position they've been in. Like, how does this change anything by just hiring Flores?
Judge Jeffrey again. A.J. Brown was seen on the sidelines reading a book.
Uh-huh.
It was Inner Excellence. I, myself, the visual was sort of interesting. But when you hear it's Inner Excellence, I don't hate it. Let's be honest. I used to bring a book in my backpack when I was nervous about writing columns, and I'd consult it every once in a while. I admire him reading a self-help book during a game. And I don't think, they asked on Sportsman, like, if Russell Wilson would have done it, would we feel differently? Yes, because we think he's a poser, right? And
yes.
So if it, but I don't think A.J. Brown was posing here. I didn't have any problem with it. Good for you reading a book. And by the way, that book, Inner Excellence, now number one over at Amazon.
Yeah, so I hope he gets a cut of that. My whole deal with it was is it felt very orchestrated.
So you think it was posing?
Like if he's just trying to, because he clearly like turned to a given passage. Why not have that passage like on a note card or something that we're not going to...
he brings the book all the time.
Okay.
It's a dog-eared book.
Okay, well, somebody else could have easily like photocopied that.
He could have laminated...
Those Microsoft Surfaces could have easily...
He could have laminated I like him schlepping... Some of us actually like a good, solid book in our hands.
It felt very much
you
like
thought
he,
it was
knew
posing.
He knew
you
where the cameras were.
I see.
Okay. I didn't like that.
If that's it...
If it was being oblivious
to the cameras, not caring, just doing what he does, if it was for effect,
correct.
Well, that's a totally different story. I guess we'll never know the answer. What is next on 92.9?
Here's what's coming next on Jason and John. Jeff joins them at 1:25. Coach Hurd will be with me today on Jeffrey Wright and Company. Jason Munn's going to join us at 2:40. Cobb with Gabe at 5 o'clock. Pre-game tonight for the Rockets at 6:30. Tip-off at 7.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back tomorrow for Now Work Is Done.